Morning, it's United States against Edwards. Counsel for the appellant, you may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court, I am Captain Krista McGrory, and along with Colonel Mark Tellatocci, we represent the appellant, Private Ty Edwards. The military judge abused his discretion when he accepted appellant's plea of guilty to escape from confinement, when the factual basis for the plea showed that appellant was not in confinement, but was in fact in custody at the time of his escape. In accepting appellant's plea of guilty to escape from confinement, the military judge ran afoul of this court's guidance and holding in the case of United States v. Elzey. This court in U.S. v. Elzey held the following, that the accused had been ordered into confinement, that he had been taken into custody for delivery to the confinement facility, and before the delivery could be effected and confinement actually imposed, the accused escaped. This court held that the offense was then escape from custody and not from confinement, as confinement had not been imposed.
Which of those two definitions did the military judge give to the accused during the plea thing?
In this case, Your Honor, the military judge gave the definition of confinement set forth in the holding in Elzey. He defined confinement as, on Joint Appendix page 30, as the physical restraint of a person within a confinement facility or under guard or escort after having been placed in a confinement facility.
And then what did he do on pages 67 and 68?
On pages 67 and 68, he went through the Providence inquiry with the accused and asked the accused if he had been ordered into confinement.
Did you know when you took off from the TDS office you were in fact still in confinement status?
Yes, Your Honor.
So is he using both definitions in the plea colloquy in your view, or just the one that you prefer?
The military judge in this case used the definition set forth in United States v. Elzey, but when accepting the Providence inquiry from the accused, went away from that definition and used purely the order. He accepted a plea that did not coincide with the definition he set forth in the Providence inquiry.
Why did your client plead guilty to it if he didn't? I mean, you're saying he didn't do it. Why did he plead guilty?
Yes, Your Honor.
I mean, I'm just saying. I understand your arguments, but he did plead guilty to doing what he was charged with. Now, the question whether he can plead guilty to doing something other than what he actually did is a different question. But why did the defense counsel allow him to plead guilty to this offense if it was not the offense that he actually committed?
Your Honor, it's the responsibility of the military judge in accepting a plea of guilty to ensure that all the facts objectively line up with the definition and elements set forth by the military judge.
I'm not disagreeing with that. I'm asking you a very different question. Why did the defense counsel allow him to plead guilty to something if it doesn't describe what he actually did?
In this case, Your Honor.
Because, I mean, he was awarded 18 months confinement. The pretrial agreement limited to 4 months, and so if we say you're right, he goes back and faces everything all over again with no pretrial agreement. Possibly,
Your Honor.
So what, I mean, basically, why would they do that?
Your Honor, what we look to in a case such as this is, was there a substantial basis in law, in fact, to question the plea? Regardless of whether or not the defense counsel allowed the appellant to plead guilty, we need to look to the record as a whole.
Right, but you understand the consequence if we agree with you, right?
We would ask this court to dismiss the charge because a fatal variance was set forth. The appellant pled guilty to an offense he was not guilty of. And as such, the government charged it wrong. And we'd ask this court to dismiss the charge and send back for a sentence reassessment and not allow to re-prefer the charge.
I could try that question another way. What if we agree with you on the providency but disagree with you on the nature of the charge? That is, what if we determine that as a matter of law, the situation met by the circumstances of the plea constitute a valid offense of escape from confinement, but that given the way that the military judge advised the accused, the plea was improvident? If we were to rule that way, and I'm not suggesting we do, we are going to, but if we did, wouldn't your client then face the prospects of having to go through the trial again without a guilty plea and face the maximum of the charge?
That is possible, yes, Your Honor, but we would ask that...
I know what you're asking for, but is that something that you're prepared to accept at this point if that's the ruling of the court? Would there be any reason why the court could not rule that way? I'm not asking you to agree with that understanding of the statute. But beyond that, if we determine the statute reads that way, is there any reason why we couldn't then order it?
We would ask that in this case, the government charged it wrong, and as a matter of policy, that this court would not send it back and have the accused retried under the offense of escape.
My question is, what if we determine that the government charged it correctly? If the government charged it correctly and that the only problem is the providence of the inquiry, is there any reason why the accused then wouldn't face a new trial at that point without the benefit of a guilty, without the benefit of a pretrial agreement if one couldn't be negotiated in the future?
No, Your Honor.
Thank you.
In a menu sort of way, could you indicate which provisions of the manual, the rules, anything you want to cite, support your view of the definition of confinement? And by menu sort of way, there's no need to argue, just say rule 9 million.
Yes, Your Honor. Obviously, we'd ask this court to look to their interpretation and holding and guidance in U.S. v. Elsie, and the fact that in that court, in that case...
No fair arguing. Just say Elsie.
Elsie, yes.
For my question, just do the summary, okay?
Yes, Your Honor.
You can do the argument later.
Yes, Your Honor. Elsie, Article 9, Article 10, Article 11, Article 12...
I may ask
you
for argument in a moment.
Yeah. Yes, Your Honor. RCM 304 Delta.
This is a test to see if you can get all the slashes and deltas and things
Yes. Right.
Okay.
RCM 302, RCM 305, and then the definition set forth in the MCM paragraphs 19.
Okay. And which is your best argument?
United States v. Elsie, Your Honor, which interpreted physical restraint as set forth in the UCMJ to constitute the delivery to a confinement facility. And in making that interpretation in their holding in that case, they looked to statutory construction, legislative intent, and were aiming to get
at the case, Elsie has to stand on a legal foundation, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
So, with respect to the legal foundation, which is your best argument?
The statutory construction in that case, Your Honor, the court in Elsie went through and looked at the distinct differences in the nature of restraint between custody and confinement and held that those two restraints are entirely different. And in coming to that conclusion, they looked at the UCMJ itself and the RCM and the MCM. And in coming to that conclusion, they looked at 9, 10, 11, and 12 as far as confinement is concerned and how that confinement in its nature as restraint is distinctly different from custody, which is meant to be temporary and only utilized until arrest, restraint, or confinement can actually be imposed. The imposition then is the delivery to the confinement facility. And they came to this interpretation by looking to the UCMJ as a whole, not just Article 9 Alpha, which says confinement is physical restraint.
Thank you.
Now, so the two are mutually exclusive. If you draw a Venn diagram, here's confinement and here's custody, and there's no overlap, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, one cannot be in both confinement and custody at the same time.
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
Yes. Custody, as set forth in Elsie and the MCM, is only a temporary status.
And confinement begins when one enters a confinement facility.
When there is a lawful order by a competent authority, as well as the delivery to a confinement.
Well, okay, there's two things. There's a lawful order into confinement, and there is actual delivery.
Right, Your Honor.
And then it continues if one is being transferred from confinement facility A to confinement facility B, and during the transfer, you know, leaves. That is escape from confinement because the status continues even if you're not physically in the facility.
Had the imposition initially...
Well, that's what I'm saying.
Yes.
If one has been ordered into and physically delivered to confinement, and then one is being moved from facility A to facility B and leaves while one is being moved, that is escape from confinement because the status follows one.
Right, yes,
okay.
Your Honor. And in this case, the imposition had not been affected.
There was an order to confinement.
There was an order,
but
yes,
the physical delivery had not been effected.
Yes, Your Honor. In this case, the appellant had been ordered into confinement by his commander, was on the way to confinement, or the magistrate's hearing at that point, and made a stop off at the TDS office where he then escaped. The facts are almost identical to the facts in U.S. v. LZ, as both LZ and the appellant made their escape prior to the imposition of confinement. The order alone is not enough. There must also be a delivery to the confinement facility, and LZ drew that line at the confinement facility in order to make a clear distinction between the two natures of restraint.
Was LZ a guilty plea?
It was not, Your Honor.
Okay.
Counsel, how do you address then the government's argument that LZ was modified by Felty, and the government's argument that Felty remains good law because to the extent that anything was abrogated in Morton, Morton did not address that underlying issue?
Your Honor, we believe that Felty actually bolsters our case, and then in that Felty was also put in confinement initially. Confinement was imposed upon him. There was a lawful order, and he was actually placed in a confinement facility, so his status continued as confinement. Obviously, the only provisions of Felty that were overturned were the closely related doctrine aspects of the case, but the analysis set forth in Felty is directly in line with LZ. It continues to distinguish between the natures of restraint, custody versus confinement, custody being temporary until another form of restraint can be imposed. So we believe that Felty bolsters appellant's case in that, again, confinement status must be lawful order plus a delivery to a confinement facility.
And why does the delivery to a confinement facility, why is that necessary in terms of any aspect of the statute, law, or policy?
A facility is required, obviously, because that's what was held in LZ, which has not been overturned and remains good law to date. But it also clarifies the distinction in the nature of the restraints. Putting the requirement only at a lawful order does not draw a clear enough line to distinguish the two natures of the restraint. If there is an ambiguous order from a commander, because the order could be oral or written, if there's an ambiguous order, we still need to be able to see the distinct natures of the restraint.
That's a different issue. That's a different issue. If there's an ambiguous order, then we have a question whether someone is or is not in confinement. If there is an unambiguous order that a person is now ordered into confinement, why isn't that a clear line for purposes of the statute?
It is not clear enough as far as distinguishing the natures of the restraint. The facility, holding that a facility is confinement, completely distinguishes it from custody, which is a temporary form of restraint. A facility is a complete deprivation of freedom. And as this court set out in LZ, that the delivery to the confinement facility changes that status from custody, which is temporary, to a more permanent deprivation of freedom. And as such, this court should uphold LZ as it remains good law. Your Honors, I see my time is running out. Unless there's other questions, I'll save the remainder for rebuttal.
Thank you, Counsel. Counsel for the government.
Chief Judge Efron, judges of the court, may it please the court, I am Captain Nathan Mammon, and I, along with Major Chris Burgess, represent the United States in this matter. The military judge did not abuse his discretion in accepting appellant's guilty plea because appellant was in confinement and in confinement status when he escaped. This court's precedent established that when a serviceman escapes while in a confinement status, he is guilty from escaping from confinement.
What are you relying on for your proposition that he was in a confinement status, the fact that confinement had been ordered?
Your Honor, there's three facts I would point to for why he was in a confinement status. Confinement status, first, was established by the fact that he had been lawfully ordered into confinement, which he admits. He acknowledges that he knew he had been lawfully ordered into confinement. But going further establishing or further solidifying that he was in a confinement status when he escaped, he had been shackled when he escaped. At the time he escaped, he had been shackled before that. He was under escort at the time he escaped. And if you look at the UCMJ, it defines confinement as physical restraint. It does not mention confinement facility. RCM 304, talking about 305, talking about pretrial restraint, does not mention confinement facility. Confinement is established by physical restraint. And in this case, appellant was physically restrained at the time he escaped.
What do you mean by the fact that the military judge gave him both definitions?
He's
like, well, which is it? How clear can that be if he's told on page 30 that confinement is physical restraint of a person within a confinement facility or under guard or escort after having been placed in a confinement facility? And then on page 68, he tells him that he was in a confinement status. Does he agree that he was in a confinement status and that an order had been given? So we have two competing definitions. One is delivery-based and one is status-based. And does it matter whether they're both, which one is correct, if the military judge is sort of playing it safe and putting them all on the table?
Well, Your Honor, I point the court to the fact that this is a guilty plea. It's evaluating whether there's a substantial basis in law, in fact, for the plea. And for that, I would point the court to the fact that...
So how does the appellant know which crime he's pleading guilty to if he has two different definitions?
I would refer the court to the stipulation, the pretrial stipulation of fact, where the appellant laid forth the facts that he believed established his guilt, including the guilt to escape from confinement. He never mentioned confinement facility there. The facts as laid out established.
But if, as a matter of law, this court believes that Elsie says that it has to be, he had to have been in a confinement facility at some point, if as a matter of law that's the case, and he couldn't plead guilty to do it, even if he says that up is down, it won't make it so, will it?
Well, Your Honor, let me answer the question this way. If Elsie were to say that, I would have to say, yes, if the court's sexual interpretation says that it has to be in a confinement facility. However, let me say that Elsie, we don't think, says that. And more importantly, in this court in Felty, Elsie cannot be understood apart from Felty, and we submit that Felty...
Can you finish my question, which is, if the judge said confinement is up, and then later says confinement is down, are you guilty? And the appellant says yes. How is that a provident plea?
You know, the providence of the plea is established by the fact that he established the facts that he knew that he was in confinement based on the status of what he'd been ordered. The elements are correctly laid out. The appellants aren't disputing. The appellant is not disputing that the elements of the offense were correctly delineated. There was a definition from the bench book. The province inquiry then laying forth the facts supporting each element. So you have before that instruction and after instruction the fact that the appellant was focused on his status, admitted to his status. There was no indication that the instruction itself affected or caused him to plea. And so for that, I don't think that there's a basis to say or a substantial basis to question the providency of the plea based on the entire record and the fact that the instruction itself did not affect his decision to plea. Judge Ryan, did I answer your question?
Well, you said...
As far as Felty, going back, yeah, Felty clarifies LC, or at least makes us understand LC, that it's focused on the status at the time of the escape. And in Felty...
But in Felty, the status at the time of the escape was he was being transferred from one confinement facility to the other.
In Felty, he had been...
He had been confined. He had been at a confinement facility. So, I mean, you're talking about confinement status, and I don't see anything under Article 95 that talks about confinement status. I see custody or confinement.
Your Honor, I would answer Felty, I guess, distinguish it by saying that he had not been confined at the time prior to his magistrate's hearing. He had been in a confinement facility, you're correct, but being in a confinement facility does not make you in confinement. You are only in confinement pursuant to provisions of being lawfully ordered in confinement. If he escaped from confinement, you can escape from custody while you're in a confinement facility. If you've not been lawfully ordered into confinement at the time you escape, you're not escaping from confinement.
Moving to a slightly different question, do you agree that under the pretrial agreement that if we find appellant's plea to be improvident, that the government is entitled to withdraw from the pretrial agreement?
Your Honor, we would agree that's correct reading of the plea agreement. We also would submit that this is an appropriate case under Sales. This court's decision in Sales and Moffitt for the Army Court to determine whether a sentencing readjustment is even necessary. The facts are here, the maximum sentences was...
What we said is that they may reassess a sentence on the remaining findings of guilty or order rehearing on a proper charge and the penalty.
Right. I would submit that the government has that option. But this is something that given the nature of the other offenses, the numerous other offenses involved, that this would be an appropriate case for sentence reassessment under Sales and Moffitt.
Was the appellant shackled when he escaped from whatever he escaped from?
Your Honor, he had been shackled prior to escape.
And was he shackled?
Not at the time of escape, Your Honor.
No.
However, he had been lawfully ordered to be shackled and never released from that order, according to the facts.
Who de-shackled him?
The defense counsel told the company commander at the time of ordering.
Did the defense counsel have a key?
No, the defense counsel told his escort to unshackle him.
And the escort did it?
The escort did it, but the defense counsel did not have the authority to unshackle him. Under lawful order,
wait a minute. You're saying confinement requires an order and restraint.
Your Honor, I wouldn't say that confinement requires restraint. I'm saying that if there is restraint in the order...
Well, you just said that. You said it's a status and two of its indicia are a lawful order and some form of restraint. Is that not the government's position?
I don't believe that I said that, but I think that... When you have both of those, you're definitely in confinement.
Okay, well, now you only have one of them. You have a lawful order and no restraint, and he walked out the door. What is he in?
Well, Your Honor, this court refers, and the service courts refer in other contexts, particularly in the custody context and other contexts, to
I'm not really interested in what the service courts say.
Right, but moral suasion, your responsibility...
Well, moral suasion is custody, isn't it?
Right, but you have an order to do something, and the order restricts your physical movement. I think that
the order is an order to someone to place him in confinement, is it not? It's not an order to him to sit there.
Right. I mean,
right. Did he disobey that order by walking out the door? No, he didn't. It wasn't an order to him. It was an order to some authority to place him in confinement. So what have you got? You've got moral suasion.
But Your Honor, I think this case is further removed from that, or closer, or easier, or more straightforward, if you will, for the fact that we do have the physical restraint elements here, both from the...
The physical restraints have been removed.
But, Your Honor, the confinement status, as laid out in the manual or in the UCMJ, is not removed unless one of lawful authority removes it. So the fact that the confinement would be the same thing as if someone had released him from a confinement facility had he been there.
Now, okay, are you saying, you're not saying, are you, I don't think, that because the defense counsel didn't really have the authority to order this, that therefore it made no difference. You're saying that it doesn't make any difference what authority the defense counsel has, or what are you saying?
Your Honor, proceeding down the danger of a hypothetical, if a magistrate judge or a military judge had ordered him released from confinement, at that point, the confinement order has been
terminated. What if the military judge had ordered him deshackled?
That element of restraint has been removed.
Okay, and then what are you left with?
He still has the escorts. He has three escorts.
Well, where was the escort when he walked out the door?
They were waiting, I'm not sure exactly off, but they were waiting for him another portion of TV.
Okay, the escort is somewhere else. He has been deshackled. I don't see anything here but moral suasion.
But, Your Honor, this court, and it's never understood, and other courts have never understood that the efficacy of the restraints is an element of confinement. If you're in confinement, whether you have an ineffective guard or an effective guard, it creates a very murky line to figure out whether you're in a confinement. Depends on the nature of your guard at the time and whether your guard was a competent or not. And so, again, that highlights the reason and I think the logic that's supported by the code of the confinement status, that when you're in that status, it's a bright line, the appellant knows he's in that status, in this case he admits that he knew he was in that status, that's a very easy line, and it's a common sense line that the code supports to determine when someone's in confinement versus custody.
So, to follow the, Judge Stuckey, were you finished with your?
I'm done.
If there's a pretrial confinement hearing, and the pretrial confinement officer orders the person to be placed in confinement, and the individual says, and the defense counsel says, we'd like to have a meeting in defense counsel's office at this time, and no physical restraints are placed on the individual. They're simply accompanied by an escort. An escort waits outside the door because the defense counsel says, I don't want you in while I'm having a confidential discussion with my client. It's the government's view that from the moment that the pretrial confinement officer orders the person to be placed in confinement and they're accompanied by an escort, that is sufficient restraint at that point to constitute confinement for purposes of the statute?
Yes, Your Honor. And I think that if you look at this court's decision in Felty, I would turn its attention to Felty, where it talks about the fact that escape from confinement is, it defines as once properly ordered into confinement. And so if that had occurred, and the hypothetical Your Honor gave me, there was escorts involved, he's been physically restrained, which is how confinement is defined under UCMJ Article 9. He has been confined, and his escape would be escape from confinement.
And then we have the problem that was previously discussed is how does that fit into the particular providence inquiry that we have here where the judge repeatedly referred to a facility and it appears from the evidence in this case that the person was never placed within a confinement facility or placed in a confinement facility in the manner described by the military judge.
Well, Your Honor, I would... I'm not sure that he repeatedly referred to a confinement facility. He did refer to it at least once.
Well, we've got a whole paragraph of it on page 30.
But going further, that was sandwiched again by the elements were properly laid out and the factual support for each element. And then I'd also identify or point this court's attention to its decisions in Negron and in Jones, where it talks about the fact that, particularly in Negron, an error in advising an accused does not always render a guilty plea improvident, where the record contains factual circumstances that objectively support the guilty plea. The plea is provident in that situation, and all the same thing is held in Jones. And so the fact that in this case there was no influence in the record shown by this confinement facility being mentioned during the province inquiry does not, and this we would submit that in this case there is no substantial basis to question that guilty plea. That the facts and the law and the elements of the offense were properly set forth and the factual support was provided for each element. Court has no further questions.
It's your opportunity, counsel.
In conclusion, because there is no substantial basis to question appellant's plea to escape from confinement, and this is because he was in a confinement status, had been confined, physically restrained at the time he escaped, we respectfully urge the court to affirm the judgment of the Army Court.
Thank you, counsel. Does the defense have rebuttal?
It is clear that no one at the trial level understood the law regarding custody or confinement. As such, Elsie remains the guiding precedent in this case as far as this court's interpretation of confinement and physical restraint. We would ask this court that you reaffirm the holding in Elsie and clarify the differences that have come up from the service courts and make the distinction between custody versus confinement. Reaffirm the sound holding in Elsie, and we ask that you find that the military judge abused his discretion in accepting the guilty plea in this case. Pending your questions, I have nothing further, Your Honors.
Thank you, counsel. We thank both counsel for the presentation today. The case is now submitted, and the court will be in recess until 9:30 a.m. tomorrow morning.
Court stands in recess until 9:30 a.m. tomorrow.